This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a look at how drones could be used and misused in hunting in Wisconsin.
First, there may be a showdown in northern Wisconsin over access to a proposed mining site. A new state law limits access to the site of a proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin's Pinocchio Range, and protesters vowed yesterday to continue hiking in the area.
Mike Simonson joins us now. He's WPR's reporter in Superior. He's been tracking this story. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So give us, please, a bit of the recent history. Why did this off-limits zone get put into place?
Well, it's kind of a work in progress, this whole mining thing. You guys, I know, have covered it very closely as well. But in June, when they first began exploratory drilling, the first day of the drilling, there was a band of a dozen or more masked people who literally raided the drill site. It was a confrontation with a lot of swearing, and it was rather intimidating. That started then that GTAC came in with bulletproof security, an Arizona firm that was showing automatic weapons and dressed in camouflage. Then the legislature stepped in and said, hey, you know, we need to have an off-limits safety zone for a couple of reasons. One, to protect workers from raids or whatever, and the other one is to protect the public in case they are just out hiking and unaware of what's going on, that the area is posted, so if there is some activity, that they're not near the machinery and that sort of thing.
And this off-limits zone kicks in this weekend, is that right?
Actually, it's in effect right now.
Oh.
And there haven't been any confrontations so far, but there's really a competition to see who can get the first ticket by the protesters.
And we've heard this week from people opposed to the mine and wanting to have access to this site. What are you hearing from them? Why do they oppose this off-limits zone?
They want to be able to monitor what's going on there. They want to be able to see if while they're drilling, while GTAC is drilling, if there are any spills, if the holes have anything kicked back, any waste rock. That is just a lot of streams, a very sensitive area, a very natural area. They want to be able to document all of the activity that they say is disruptive to the Pinokis.
You mentioned that there was more or less a contest to see who might get the first citation. What kind of things are protesters talking about doing to protest, I guess, both the mine and this exclusion zone?
Well, they're talking about the Golden Goose Award, trying to find an egg hunt or something like that. And the egg, I guess, is a ticket. It's a peaceful thing. They're planning on and have been snowshoeing in the area. They've been taking pictures of this of themselves in the off-limits area. The sheriff's departments in Iron and Ashland County have followed that. Nobody's being secretive of it. They're trying to keep it upbeat. But even below all of this, this could be a serious thing. If somebody notches it up and if either on law enforcement or GTAC or the protesters, this may not be funny anymore.
You mentioned that protesters have been public about their opposition and their plans to go onto this site. What have you heard from police as far as enforcement?
They're going to enforce it as trespassing. Ironically, I asked the district attorney in Iron County and I asked the two sheriffs, Sheriff Brennan and Furick of Ashland and Iron County, so you write them a ticket and that's for how much? And they're not sure because the statute isn't clear, but a normal trespassing ticket would be at least $200. But they're not sure. The DA isn't sure. The sheriff's not sure. They don't write, usually you don't have to write tickets for people walking in the woods. So this is, again, breaking new ground. But the sheriff's departments, this is a pain for them. These are small departments and very geologically large areas, and they have other work to do as well. So it's no joke to them, and they're going to enforce it. But they're going to enforce it only if GTAC complains, and GTAC has brought in their own security firm. They won't say how many and who it is, if it's bulletproof, but Sheriff Brennan told me that they are unarmed.
So, and that's been GTAC's statement on this. They've got their security. They will report incidents to the police as they happen?
Yeah. I mean, unless it's like that raid in June, which is a very isolated incidents, the only time there was a confrontation. Otherwise, everything's been very friendly, very civil. But in case it is something where they believe that their workers are in danger, then apparently the private security would take action to protect the geologists and the drillers.
Getting back to state law briefly, this no-fly zone or no-walk zone, no-hike zone, it doesn't specify any particular additional punishment beyond whatever the local trespassing ordinances might be?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's part of the thing that we're going to find out this week. If the sheriff writes out a ticket, and here's your ticket, you know, you got to go to court on this date. But the protester says, but I'm not leaving. Well, that means that they'll probably have to arrest that person. Now, keep in mind that last weekend, 50 people went snowshoeing in the off-limits zone from the LCO Harvest Project area. And it could be 100 people next weekend. Iron County, Ashland County, they don't have the resources to, they don't have any paddy wagons.
Is there talk of, maybe this is too soon to ask this question, is there talk of bringing in outside enforcement? I don't know who that would be, state police or DNR wardens or somebody to help those local police units.
Yeah, it's a possibility. The governor says that he's not going to activate the National Guard, but there is DNR. There are DNR wardens, and there is mutual assistance with local police departments, Ashland PD or Mercer or Hurley, and I suppose that could happen. It's maybe they just want to make the point of we don't think any public lands should be off limits. This is our land, and we should be able to observe it. We should be able to use it.
Civil disobedience, is that, do you think, going to be the wave of the future for protesters as this project goes forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they're going to fight this any way they can. Probably the most effective would be in the courts. The tribes certainly have taken a lead role in doing that, and they're using the federal government. And the feds have already said they don't like the way the state's going to go about the new permitting process from the new rules, permitting rules passed last year. So they're going to take a separate road. So I think courts, but also, you know, PR, staying out in the public eye, which is a pretty easy thing to do because this story is being washed around the country.
Mike, you put up another story that went nuts around the world about mainly a picture, the ice caves up on the Apostle Islands sea caves that are all iced over. Is there some kind of connection? Are protesters using that, mining opponents using that to try to strengthen their case?
Right. The sea caves are quite a ways away, but it is on Lake Superior. And the Smithsonian Magazine ran a story from the story that we ran, and the comments were from largely from the anti-mining people, so they have a national forum to do that. They said, look, Lake Superior is beautiful. These caves are incredible. Look at this. This is being threatened by this mining project because the hill runs down into the Bad River watershed and ultimately into Lake Superior. So, yeah, the Smithsonian Magazine is being used right now.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, you bet, Rob.
That's Mike Simonson. He's WPR's Superior Bureau reporter. Drones are in the news a lot for their military uses, but they're picking up popularity in the civilian world for work and for hobbies.
Our next guest is thinking ahead about how drones might be used in hunting here in Wisconsin. In a recent piece, he wrote about ethical issues drones could raise. Paul Smith joins us now. He's outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, I wonder if we could start by having you give us some examples so we have in mind the kinds of ethical issues that we're talking about as we go into the discussion. What sorts of things could drones be used for in hunting that are unethical?
Well, in hunting in Wisconsin, for instance, they're not only unethical, but they're illegal. So we have a state law that would prohibit the use of drones for hunting. It's in our state administrative code. And the way it appears is that it's a rule that governs aircraft, but our DNR has said that that drones fit the definition of aircraft. So it would be illegal to use drones to scout, harass, herd, or hunt game in Wisconsin. So it's not only unethical, but it's illegal.
So even if it's not legal, as drones become more available, do you think some people will try to use them for hunting in some of the ways you just talked about, herding or harassing wildlife, that kind of thing?
Sure. Well, that's one of the reasons I wrote the article, and I proposed some imaginary scenarios. The use of technology is always very tempting to human beings, and So there would be great temptation. People fly aircraft in certain parts of the world and spot game and then hunt it. To have a tool in your hands that you could fly up, look around, and find game would, I think, be certainly tempting to some. And we should always state that the vast majority of hunters are ethical and law-abiding. But this issue now, and with the increasing availability of drones, next year the Federal Aviation Administration is scheduled to publish a rule on the use of drones for commercial applications in the U.S., and when that's done, most people expect manufacturers to produce more, and the price will come down, and so the use for all applications will increase. That's what's predicted. So there would be some folks who might be tempted to try use a drone for an unethical application. Recently, for instance, the Colorado Commission of Parks and Wildlife felt it necessary to explicitly state that the use of drones is illegal in that state. Wisconsin officials haven't weighed in on that yet, Veronica, but it's possible that they might publish such information in our hunting pamphlets just to make sure people are aware of the law.
Now, you do give two or three examples, scenarios in your piece about the way drones could be used, some things you're sort of brainstorming ahead on. One of them uses drones to locate, let's say, a deer, and then the hunter can just get in position and shoot. That's one. What are some of the others? Paul, are you with us? Did we lose Paul? We had him a second ago. Well, in the meantime, tell us what you think. Are you worried about the application of drones in hunting? We talked about a scenario in which a hunter might use a drone to get up there, find the animal that the hunter's hunting, and in this case, not engage in fair chase policies and practices in hunting, but just get in position and shoot the animal. But also, PETA has said and encouraged its members to use drones to instead go and try to watch the hunters. And let's see if we have Paul back on the line with us. Paul, are you there? Let's see. Still working on getting Paul on the line. And what do you think? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. If you're a hunter, what do you think about this? Do you think this is something you're worried about? Should we be out ahead of this one and looking at it and talking about the way that technology could change things? 1-800-642-1234 as we try to get Paul Smith back on the line. Paul, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. I don't know. You dropped out on there for a moment, but you're back, so that's fantastic. And so I don't know if you heard my last question. So you ran through a few scenarios in your piece about ways that drones could be used, things that you're concerned about. And one of them, you talk about a hunter using a drone to locate the animal, then just getting in position and shooting and not really using the fair chase practices that most hunters use. Tell us about some of the others.
Well, in the piece, I also propose one where someone would perhaps herd an animal into position to take a shot, even perhaps going into a neighbor's property and driving game from that location to their own. I also talk about the use, before we lost contact there, I know you mentioned the PETA campaign to use drones to monitor hunter activity and to harass hunters. So we see drones surfacing on every side of the equation. That type of hunter harassment activity is illegal in Wisconsin already, and recently the state of Illinois passed a law there making it illegal in that state. One of the areas that is very interesting to me going forward is related to wildlife viewing. So not hunting, but actually wildlife viewing and the use of drones to get close to, say, nesting birds or big flocks of waterfowl.
Right, and so I guess the scenario would be something like, you know, you could watch an eagle's nest with your binoculars, or you could get right on in there with a drone camera and see things you never could have seen, you know, before. And I guess you're worried that that's going to affect the wildlife and maybe they'll leave the nest.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen videos taken with drones that get very close to some wildlife, and you can see the animals reacting to it. And if you can imagine someone who spent a lifetime looking through binoculars at birds that are perhaps at a distance of a half a mile, quarter of a mile, or using spotting scopes, and offered this option of using a drone to fly close to it, there'll be a temptation there. There aren't really, we have a wildlife harassment law in Wisconsin, wildlife viewing is much less regulated than hunting, so it'll be interesting to see how organizations come out perhaps in and have a position statement on the use of drones in wildlife viewing. I called the National Audubon Society, for instance, and they don't have a position right now on the use of drones, or at least weren't able to locate one. As this issue moves forward, it'll be interesting to see how certain groups come out on the issue of drones.
Well, let's take a caller. We have Lacey. She's joining us from Waukon, Iowa. Hi, Lacey.
Hi.
What do you think about drones and the way we might use them?
Well, I think that it's kind of cheating. The fun of hunting is, like, tracking them, too. And only people who have more money will be able to use the drones. It wouldn't be fair to the other people.
Right, so you're saying it could give some people the advantage in hunting, and also Lacey's getting at the fair chase sort of ethic of behind hunting. What would you say to that, Paul?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I would agree 100%, and every ethical hunter would, and that's the point, one of the points that the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, that's a conservation organization, they came out in January and issued a statement making exactly those points, that it violates fair chase, and also it violates this tenet that we have that game should be available to all of us, and not just wealthy or not allocated by means of ability to get at it through different means. So, I would agree, and she's making points that hopefully. You know, Veronica, I haven't called all around the country to find what laws are in place in different states, but I believe most would already outlaw the use of drones in this way that Lacey said. It's cheating.
Do you think that the hunting community in Wisconsin and beyond will coalesce on a point of view about this, or is this something that's going to be contentious down the road? Some people are going to want to use drones to hunt.
Yeah, it's a great idea. A great question. I believe they will coalesce around it, and I think as it becomes more feasible to consider, right now you can't walk into sporting goods stores that I know of and buy a drone. But I wouldn't rule that out. It's probably a question of when, right? When we can go to our various commercial outlets of any sort and buy one. So I think that over the next couple of years, I believe we'll start to see various organizations and bodies take positions on it and coalesce around it. I know there's already an unofficial consensus in the hunting community that the use of drones is unethical, illegal, and should not be pursued.
Well, in our last 30 seconds here, could drones be used, you know, on the other side to catch poachers, maybe, for example?
Absolutely. I think, and they are used in Africa for that purpose now. There are also some very good, we should say, that there are excellent uses of drones, very constructive, productive uses, including for monitoring remote wildlife. In Indonesia, they're used to monitor orangutans high in the trees. And so
that's another aspect. And we're going to have to leave it there, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Paul Smith, outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about his recent piece on drones, hunting, and ethics.
Coming up.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're listening to Little Boxes by folk music legend Pete Seeger, as we just heard in the news. He passed away yesterday at the age of 94. He wrote some of the best-known American folk songs of the 20th century, including If I Had a Hammer and Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
If I Had a Hammer was one of my lullaby songs for the kids back in the day, largely because it's one of the few songs I knew all the words to.
And it's a great song.
Oh, it's a good song. Definitely, yeah. Well, Pete, thanks for the music.
Coming up on Central Time, Steve Paulson of To the Best of Our Knowledge joins us to share some of his favorite big idea books.
First, if you were born between the years of 1946 and 1964, you're what we would call a baby boomer, a product of that post-World War II spike in childbirth in the United States.
Now, baby boomers usually make headlines because of how their impending retirement will affect things like Social Security and Medicare. But today we're going to take on some time and just simply revel in what it means to be a baby boomer with political satirist P.J. O'Rourke.
His new book, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again, faces the question of boomer identity with satire and wit. He's the best-selling author of 16 books, including Don't Vote, Parliament of Whores, and Eat the Rich. PJ, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It sounds awfully cold out there, and I speak from New Hampshire, where we know of cold.
It's a bit on the chilly side, I won't lie to you. Well, if there's one thing that makes somebody uniquely a boomer, what is it?
Oh, no. Actually, it's just being born between 1946 and 1964. It sort of comes with the territory. I don't know quite why that is, you know, I mean, because it's greatest generation, you sort of had to be like on deck for World War II, and you didn't have to fight it exactly, but you had to be like part of the struggle. You had to experience the depression. We're just here because we're here because we're here.
Well, boomers are one of the most talked about generations, I think the most talked about generation these days. Do you feel a kinship with the people in that generation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's the last generation of Americans that will ever grow up with a very unified culture. I mean, not perfectly, of course, but I mean, there were only three stations on TV. We all grew up in these, the inner suburbs where, you know, there were lots of houses were close together and there were lots of people, lots of kids our age. We mostly went to, with the exception of a few rich kids and a few very badly behaved kids, we went to public schools or we went to Catholic schools, which are just public schools with hitting. And so we really have this, and we listened to the same top 40 stuff. There might have been a little variation between the R&B list, but I grew up within 50 miles of Detroit, and so we always got the first Motown. The releases would be right there on CKLW, the big station that was over in Windsor, Canada. So we got that side of the culture too, and it was it's remarkable how much alike we all are.
I grew up listening to CKLW too, but in a later generation. Well, when it comes to personality, what is distinctive about the baby boomers? And actually, one thing you write is they made the universe personal. How did they do that?
Well, it's a very self-oriented. You can almost take the word self, put a hyphen on it, and add what you will, and you will have described the baby boom. A couple of words that won't work, like self-denying. We're not particularly that. Excuse me, our modest cold, only down around zero, has caused me to come down with a chest ditto.
Oh, no.
So I'm talking, I probably sound a bit like a frog on the radio.
Sound pretty good to us.
Yeah,
you must be.
A happy frog.
So it's an extremely I say in the book, we're not selfish, because selfish just means too concerned with self. I mean, we are the self, you know. I mean, it's not something we're just, you know, concerned with. And so it's a very, very self-absorbed, very self-conscious generation. And what interests me about this is it didn't work out all that badly. It's a little bit like Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations. Adam Smith got the brainstorm that everybody works for their own benefit. The baker and the brewer and the butcher don't give you dinner because they love you. They give you dinner for their own benefit. And yet, when people do this all across the world, working only for their own benefit, it ends up benefiting mankind. And the baby boom self-absorption is something, we're sort of emotional Adam Smiths. Our self-absorption, we're so self-absorbed that we couldn't stop to hate. You know, we never got it together to belong to any nasty mass movement like the Nazis or the communists. We're just, you know, and, you know, we kind of like everybody. We want to be liked. We want to like other people.
You sound like you're lovingly exasperated with your generation. Mostly
yeah,
lovingly.
That's a perfect
but...
phrase. Yes, lovingly exasperated would be exactly right. You know, I mean,
what about boomer backlash that has, you know, we've seen more of in the past several years as generations coming up, as you say, are kind of going, check, please, for the boomers,
yeah,
you know?
I mean, we are definitely clogging the python as we head down, you know, the snake digestive tract. There's no doubt about that we're much, very much in the way of generations to come. And then, of course, we're costing them a fortune. And, I mean, we're already costing them a fortune, and we're going to cost them a lot more because the youngest baby boomers turned 50 this year, one of the reasons I wrote this book. And so here it comes, you know, in terms of Medicare. And, of course, we have every intention of living to 140. The younger generations are going to be angry at us. And the only thing I can really say in our excuse is that these programs, namely Social Security and Medicare, were not invented by us. They were invented by the generation prior to the Greatest Generation, and by the Greatest Generation in the case of Medicare. And they seem to have been invented without anybody paying any attention to demographic trends. I mean, the whole Social Security and Medicare is predicated on everybody dropping dead at 76.5. Oops. And that wasn't happening even back when Social Security was put together, let alone when in the 60s when Medicare came along.
You divvied the baby boomers up in your book from seniors, the first cohort, up to the freshmen. You just mentioned the ones hitting their 50s now. How was life different between those classes of the baby boomers?
Well, it was hard to sort. You know, when you're talking about 75, 76 million people, obviously there are differences between them. And that's without even going into, you know, people who happen to come from a very different background, you know, or belong to them. Just talking about average baby boomers, it becomes very hard to talk about so far as numbers. I felt I had to sort them, and sorting them by class or race or gender or something like that just didn't seem like the baby boom way. It's not the way my generation thinks about things. So really, time, and I thought, like high school classes, that's perfect. You know, it's a generation that never grew up, you know, so let's sort them by high school classes. I belong to the senior class, late 1940s. We, you know, we were at the cutting edge of all this, out in the bow wave of the voyage of discovery, and yet at the same time, we were very closely tethered to the Greatest Generation, and so we ended up being sort of keel hauled, kind of put, you know, dragged under the boat, and we turned up a little. I mean, the best way I can explain the senior class is to point out that both Hillary Clinton and Cheech of Cheech and Chong are members of the senior class of Baby Boom. Now put those two together. You know?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the freshman class, if we can. Now, they include Barack Obama,
well,
Sarah Palin,
and
Stephen
and
Colbert, and Coulter. Is that significant? You got all those people in the freshman class?
Yes. What's significant to me about the freshmen is that they grew up in a world created and formed by the Baby Boom. And they don't even know that there's anything different. The older members of the baby boom, the seniors, the juniors, and the sophomores, are more aware of the prior generations. By the time the freshmen come along, I mean, some of the freshmen are actually children of the senior, the time span of the baby boom being so long. And Very few of the freshmen are actually children of the Greatest Generation because they were basically done with having kids by then. And so they just look at this world that the baby boom sort of shaped, and they just take it totally for granted. And they also don't have any real visceral feeling for the events that shaped the baby boom, which would be the whole civil rights struggle, the opposition to the war in Vietnam, the explosion of drugs, the easily available, inexpensive birth control, all these feminism, all these things that really shaped the baby boom are like givens to the freshmen. I mean, feminism is Maud. It's a television show your parents like, you know.
We're speaking.
War, if they remember at all, it's just something that was just unaccountably on television all the time. My wife, who belongs to this age cohort, says, I couldn't, you know, when I was a kid, I just thought we always had a war, and it was always on TV. It was just one of those things that was always on TV for no reason you could figure out, like Ed McMahon, you know.
We're speaking with political satirist P.J. O'Rourke about his new book, The Baby Boom, and we'd like to hear from you.
What about you? Are you a baby boomer, or did you raise one? Were you raised by one? What do you think is their most defining characteristic, and have they made a positive impact on America and the world? We'll take your calls in just a bit at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back with political satirist P.J. O'Rourke. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Baby Boom, and we'd like to hear from you.
Are you a baby boomer, or the parent of one, or the child of one? What do you think is the most defining characteristic? What is the key part of a baby boomer personality, or what was the key event that shaped their lives? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to your calls in just a couple minutes. PJ, before we get to those calls, though, something I always wonder, when we did duck and cover drills in the 1970s, it was about tornadoes. But you guys grew up with the threat of nuclear war from the late 40s through the Cuban Missile Crisis and beyond. How big a deal was that? How much did it shape the way baby boomers thought, or the way you thought?
Much less, I think, than would be imagined. I mean, for one thing, it was just, this is grown-up stuff, and as younger kids, we were pretty sure that these bombs only killed grown-ups, which, depending on how we were getting along with the grown-ups at the moment, was, you know, an idea that might have had a certain dark appeal, you know. And it was just, you know, basically beyond imagination. And then by the time I was a sophomore in high school in the Cuban Missile Crisis, it really looked like this might happen. And my response to this, and I think it's a perfect baby boom response, I had a very cute young lady who was my lab partner in biology lab, so cute that I dissected her frog for her. And I turned to her and I said, let's do it. And she looked at me like she kind of looked at the frog, you know. And I said, no, I'm serious. You know, we may all be dead, you know, in a day or two. And we don't want to die without having, you know, done it. And she said, I'll think about it over the weekend. And then over the weekend, the crisis was solved.
Well, I hope you got a little smoother in your approach as you went along.
You'd have to check with my wife, but, you know, I kind of doubt it.
All right. Well, let's get a caller in on this. Judy's with us in Fond du Lac. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm a member of that freshman class, one of the younger baby boomers. I was born in 62. And I kind of disagree with what your guest was saying about us not caring about feminism. I mean, I think it had a lot to do with who your siblings were, you know, your cousins and everybody else that were growing up around you that were all baby boomers as well. My father was a veteran of the Second World War. And, you know, those issues were they were just daily in their household, you know, civil rights and feminism, since you growing up knowing what depression was like. I mean, I think that defines us all together as well. It's just,
Even
though we didn't live through depression, we had...
Let's get PJ's take on that.
I don't think that the younger members of the baby boom, let alone the people that come after the baby boom, didn't care about feminism. In fact, I think that they abide much better by the ideals of feminism than people earlier did. But they take it as a given. It was never new to them. I mean, the older baby boomers grew up in a very, you know, Mad Men world. And so when feminism first came along, it was kind of surprising to even to those of us who consider ourselves very liberal and liberated and who would never knowingly do anything sexist. And we just sort of didn't understand how fundamentally sexist all of Western civilization had been since, you know, Moses. And so what the freshman baby boomers don't feel is the surprise, the shock of the new.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to John in Rhinelander. John, hi.
Hi. You know, PJ, I think thanks to you and National Lampoon and our other great comedians of the age here, we kind of respect humor more than we respect political debate. If you can make us laugh, we tend to go with it, and we tend to overlook the extreme politics now.
Well, you know, I think that's very true, and I think that that is, again, one of the unintentional blessings that the baby boom, we didn't set out to do any good here. We were just, you know, making fun of everything at the National Lampoon, and, of course, Saturday Night Live and movies like Animal House, and then on down to Bill Maher and to Jon Stewart and Colbert. And but, you know, if you look at politicians and all the things they've done over the centuries, not just lately, but over the whole time of political history, they don't deserve to be taken seriously. They deserve to be made fun of. And I think that the fact that we do make fun of them now and that we don't take them as seriously as we once took them, it helps keep us from following idiots. You know, I mean, that little guy in from Austria, you know, with his like his little booger mustache, you know, and a funny automatic arm thing, you know, I mean, that just wouldn't go down with us.
So now you're talking about what you sort of describe in your book as, you know, the eternal childhood of the boomer generation. And it makes me wonder, did boomers, do you think, ever grow up, or do you still feel like big kids?
I think we're big kids. Yeah, no, I don't think we ever grew up. And you can see this in some of the downside of the baby boom. I mean, given, you know, the sort of deficit problems and the, you know, political polarization in the United States, we have not, I mean, we make good fun of it, but we have not stepped in and actually done anything about it, because that would require a measure of maturity that, frankly, I don't feel my generation has, you know?
What do you think of the generations since? Do you see more maturity or less maturity in the generations that followed the baby boom?
Well, much more. I mean, once you get past their silly clothes and the nose rings and stuff, and their music that's just noise. But no, I actually think they're much more mature. I mean, it seems as though Generation X and Generation Y and the millennials have kind of looked at the whole baby boom experience and decided to take the take the good things and leave the bad things alone. I think they're more cautious about all forms of promiscuity, from the ideological to drug use. I think they, you know, they cast a cooler eye on things. They're less high on their own cooking than the baby boom was. And no, my experience with them has been really all positive.
Thanks, man.
You're welcome.
All right, let's go to Dean in Madison next. Hi, Dean.
Hello there.
Hi, Dean.
I'm just going to. Oh, nice to hear you. It's been a fascinating show. It's about us.
Yeah. What could be better?
I remember I was 13 when the Beatles came out in '64, and I already started playing music a little bit before that, but I was playing polkas and Lawrence Welk and things like that. And then all of a sudden, this great, incredible music explosion took place with the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Animals, Searchers, and Hollies, and on and on and on.
Oh, remember them all.
Oh, yeah. And it just changed their whole way of look and dress. And it just changed everything. Nothing was ever the same after that. And we got to the point, I think, by 1968 or 9, I think we all thought if we could just all sit around and just play music 18, 20 hours a day, we could make the world right.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that
call,
Dean.
Well, we certainly wouldn't have time to kill each other, would we?
Do you think that music is more important to boomers? I mean, a lot of boomers would tell you you created the best music ever.
We didn't take credit for creating. And yes, it's important to remember that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, all those people are older than the baby boomers. We're more Grand Funk Railroad with VR and Donnie and Marie, you know, truth be told. But we were the great fans and appreciators of this music, and the music was a major break with the Greatest Generation in a way that there's been no major break since. I mean, I noticed that my kids appreciate the music from my era probably a good deal more than I appreciate the music from their era, you know. But, I mean, you will still hear college kids listening to the Rolling Stones, listening to the Beatles, and that's not imaginable with Perry Como, you know, from my point of view.
PJ, I can't let you go without talking a little bit about sex. Apart from the, you know, dissected frog Cuban Missile Crisis story, how did baby boomers change the way the world thought about sex, or vice versa, I guess? That's my thermostat.
Well, you know, we really took all the freedom and none of the responsibility. I would not say that that's one of the things that we have to be greatly proud of. I mean, yes, it's much better, you know, that people's whatever kind of sexuality they have can be expressed and that people aren't as uptight about all this. On the other hand, we also unleashed, you know, just an amazing amount of, like, children with single parents, you know, and the other parent is whatever, you know, gone. That's not that good for society. I'm hoping future generations will look at that model and think, no.
So all in all, would you say that the boomers have made the world a better place on balance?
Yes, I think so. And I think it really has to do with a sort of, like, somewhat self-absorbed but nonetheless good-hearted nature of the generation. I mean, you can see it most, I think, in the kind of war that has been conducted since the baby boom sort of took over politically. And yes, there have been wars, and there have been terrible deaths, and it's not pretty, and it's certainly not perfect. But the scale of these conflicts compared to even Vietnam and Korea, let alone World War I, World War II, you see a much, much smaller scale of military conflict. And, you know, that's something we'd like to have go away completely. But if you can't make it go away completely, making it smaller is next best thing.
PJ, in our last minute or so, baby boomers aren't done yet. What do you want to see from them in the rest of their baby boomer generation?
Well, now that we're really in charge of politics, and politics is not a young person's game, you know, now that we're really at the helm, I would like to see a little bit more sensible argument, a little less screaming, a little more of facing facts. I'm not asking for bipartisanship. I mean, you know, I think the nation is legitimately split down the middle on a lot of issues, but I am asking for, you know, for people to talk to each other civilly and figure out what we can do and what we can't do. And you know, I've like anybody else, even though I'm politically conservative, I've just had it with all this. You know, I just. And I think that I can join hands with anybody from the left on that.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope the parties are listening to you. PJ, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, you're really welcome. Thank you.
We've been speaking with PJ O'Rourke about his new book. It's called The Baby Boom.